Hello everyone and welcome back to Take One. This is your host Juan Pablo Sá talking to you from the CITR station at UBC Point Grey campus, located in the unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh Nations. First of all, I will start this episode by saying that it feels good to be back. It's been approximately a year ever since my last episode of Take One, which was, you know, my review of Dune Part 2 all the way back in March of 2024. You know, not only my review of Dune Part 2, but also talking about some of the differences in between the first book by Frank Herbert and, you know, both movies by Denis Villeneuve, Dune Part 1, which came out in 2021, and Dune Part 2, which came out in 2024. So yeah, it's been a while. Life got crazy for a bit, but, you know, it's good to be back. Now, life is a lot more stable, so hopefully I will be able to do Taekwon in a more consistent and reliable way. So first of all, just to get the housekeeping out of the way, I will start by saying that Taekwon will now be happening live on air here at the CITR on a bi-weekly basis. So once every 2 weeks, there will be a new Taekwon episode every Tuesday at 5 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. And of course, that is 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So without further ado, let's jump right into this episode. And today, I have a very special episode for all of you, and that is the case, because there is a bunch of content that I recorded, a lot of episodes that I filmed during or right after the Vancouver International Film Festival, you know, last year's Vancouver International Film Festival, which happened in late September slash early October. And I haven't released that content, and I've been waiting for the right time, you know, for the right moment to release it, and I think this is it. You know, every year in the first couple of months of the year, you know, us film fans, we always look back at, you know, the movies that came out last year. You know, what were some of the best films of the year before? Of course, we are currently right now in award season. You know, the Golden Globes just happened, Critics' Choice nominations, SAG Award nominations, and of course, the Oscar nominations were recently released. So considering that, I figured this was the best time for me to, you know, finally talk about some of the best movies that I saw last year in 2024 at the Vancouver International Film Festival. And not only some of the best movies that I saw last year, but also some great interviews that I did last year with filmmakers that had films come out back in 2024. And, you know, I don't know why I said interviews as if in plural, because there's only one. But the point is, last year during the Vancouver International Film Festival, I had the chance, you know, I was lucky enough, I had the opportunity to interview the one and only Colin Gibson. For those of you who don't know, Colin Gibson is an incredible production designer who has, you know, worked as a production designer for movies such as Mad Max Fury Road and recently Furiosa, which was a movie that came out last year that I thought was great. He came here to Vancouver for the Vancouver International Film Festival, and, you know, I was lucky enough to get to interview him. I genuinely think he is one of the, you know, most well-read people I've ever interviewed. I was just shocked by the amount of knowledge and references and allusions, and, you know, the way he used language and references to drive his point was just completely fascinating. Truly, truly a fascinating person, and I really enjoyed interviewing him. So, without further ado, I will play the interview that I had with Colin Gibson back in October of 2024. That said, before we do so, I think we should go on a quick break, you know, on a quick musical break, not only to listen to some ads and PSAs, but also because I will be playing, in this episode, I will be playing two songs that are featured in the aforementioned, you know, the previously mentioned movies, Mad Max Fury Road and Furiosa. Let's begin with my favorite song from Mad Max Fury Road, the 2015 film, and that song is Brothers in Arms by Junkie XL. So we're going on a quick musical break, and when we're back, we're going to jump right into my interview with Colin Gibson, the incredible production designer of Fury Road and Furiosa. But here we go.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya, and the Skakhlia, Talitin, who Musqueam must stay.
Knock, knock. Guess who? MRG Live coming right back at you, this time with a whole new list of upcoming live shows by your favorite artists. Hear this. Marika Hackman, Faye Webster, Empress of, Peter Cat Recording Co., and The Rare Occasions are a few of the artists MRG Live is bringing to you. Follow at MRG Live Official on Instagram to stay tuned with all the artists performing near you.
We stand for peace, we stand for justice for the people of Palestine and for the upholding of international law.
On November 30th, join Irish for Palestine BC for a night of crack agus ciol, including trivia, music, dancing, and fundraising for an important cause. All funds raised will be donated to Medical Aid for Palestinians, a long-standing charitable organization responding to the humanitarian emergency in Gaza and Lebanon by providing on-the-ground medical supplies and complex care to children and families impacted by violence. Tickets are $15, and the event will be held in the function room of Foy's Irish Bar. To find out more, visit at Irish for Palestine BC on Instagram. That's at Irish for Palestine BC with a numerical 4. Saoirse don Phalastine.
Hello everyone and welcome to Take One. Today I am here with the incredible, the amazing, the one and only Colin Gibson, who in my opinion is one of the most talented and best production designers in the business. Of course, Colin won an Oscar for Best Production Design for his work in Mad Max Fury Road, where he created some of the most insane vehicles I have ever seen in my life. And believe it or not, most recently he did that all over again with Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. That said, Colin is not only a production designer, but he also worked as art director for movies such as Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and Babe. And most importantly, he was also art director and associate producer for the movie that completely traumatized me as a child, Babe, A Pig in the City. Colin, to this day, I still have nightmares of that one scene where the dog is dangling from the bridge and almost drowning.
Fortunately saved by Babe.
He is, after like a minute and a half of animals looking at it very, very sad, while in slow motion we see him twitching.
Yeah, I still don't understand it. Warner Brothers didn't seem to realize they were getting the George Miller version of Babe, because the first one had been directed by another man, which was a little bit more gentle and storybook, but George can't help himself. You would have been more traumatized. There were things that we were meant to shoot. You know how The monkeys use Babe to break into the convenience store.
Uh-huh.
Well, in our script, when Babe finally makes it back past the hanging dog that upset you,
uh-huh,
and goes into the room, they're not eating stolen jelly beans. They're smoking, because that's what Mickey Rooney had taught them to do. So, the studio decided that we shouldn't really have smoking monkeys.
I wonder why. You know, I'm sure 4-year-old Juan would have loved that.
I think you would have been. You would have needed a cigarette after the suicidal dog hanging from the bridge.
Fair enough. Okay, well, Colin, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Now, before we jump into the more Mad Max-specific questions, because, you know, of course, that is what I would love to talk to you about, let's begin with a more general question, and that question would be, what does it mean to be a production designer?
Well, for me, it means having a life without having a real job. So it's a grand and wondrous thing, production design. Basically, we just get to get to notionally supply the environments that help tell a story, give the visuals a much more visceral sort of feel, and help make a space for grace, hopefully, that directors and actors will take advantage of and put across even better the story that they wish, need, have to tell.
Moving on into the world of Mad Max, you know, preparing for this interview, I did watch a bunch of other interviews that you did, you know, with other channels and with other networks.
My condolences.
No, they were very nice. And one of the things that interested me the most is the amount of thought and consideration that came behind each of the vehicles that we see in Mad Max Fury Road and in Furiosa Mad Max Saga. One of the things that really interested me is when you talked about how all of these vehicles tell a story, but not only do they tell a story, but they also tell us about the nurture and the nature of their owners. And that brings me to my next question, which is, how are the vehicles in Fury Road and Furiosa part of the storytelling, and what do they tell us about the riders, the places they come from, and the tribes they belong to?
Well, I think probably more so Fury Road than Furiosa. Furiosa is a much more linear storytelling, takes place over a longer period of time. Fury Road was always a mad chase followed by a mad race, and that speed meant that you only ever get to meet any of the what we call the characters. They weren't just cars, they weren't just vehicles, they were what carried the people. So if you're going to work out what people are going to drive to hell, you want to work out first what drives them. And so there was a lot of thought that went into how the War Boys designed their own process, why they built things the way they would, what they put into it, how the little that you have becomes fetishized and becomes important. And so because George had written it all originally, there's no script, so it was all written as storyboards, and these explosive beats meant that you only had a brief moment of each of these, but you wanted to make that moment your chance to tell the story of, say, those three War Boys. So why are there three? Because that's how big the Volkswagen was, and that's how many they would take, and George needed one of them to shoot left to right and the other one to throw a stick. So you work that into it, and then we started with the story, and then I'd sit down with a mechanic, a steel worker, a salvage artist, and a set decorator, and we would discuss, where did the car come from? How did they find the bits? What are we trying to say? So, you know, we'd find a Volkswagen. Obviously, we all want to blow up a bug three or four times. And so we went out and found the Volkswagens. We bought them back. We knew that we were going to put a V8, double aspirate, holly carbs, all that sort of mechanical nonsense. But then it's also, it only appears in the film three times. And very briefly, at the last, it's rammed into from behind. We want to see it die as a Catherine wheel. We need it to get to between 85 and 90 kilometres an hour. So we wind up the power, we lift up the legs, we raise the back slightly so that it can be tipped and thrown, and then we put, I did put a convex lens onto the back of it so that we could have a cut of the crash just before. We never ended up using it, but all of those things were thought about because those quick beats, those brief moments, turned those three guys who you didn't recognize as anything but three more bald, white, good-looking six-packs, suddenly turned them into characters that you knew something about, that you cared about, that you knew were important to you. So there were never, in, you know, the Dirty Dozen, the first 11 or 12, are really only there just to get killed on our way towards Yul Brynner. But in this case, we wanted everyone to be important, and the detail and thought that went into each of those beats meant that even if you only saw them for a second, hopefully they'd mean enough to you for you to care.
Moving on, and considering your answer to the previous question, in Fury Road and Furiosa, we have two very different villains. You know, in Fury Road, we have, of course, Immortan Joe. And in Furiosa, we have Dr. Dementis. And even though these villains are very different, they still feel like they belong to the same universe. So, considering your answer to the previous question, what would you say are some of the key differences between Immortan Joe's entourage and the vehicles that are ridden by those belonging to Dr. Dementis' tribe?
The variation is that Immortan Joe was an iron fist in an iron glove. He was feudalism and fascism and fundamentalism. So he was offering a sort of faux religion of you could all make a comeback in the garden of Valhalla. You know, just die for me. It worked throughout history, and we're giving it a go again. So he was making the Citadel great again, with apologies to Donald. And so he had this life. It was a more static, and from that he rang the triad, the Bullet Farm, Gastown, Citadel, which were the four W's that were the motivating force. So that's water from the Citadel, wheels and fuel from Gastown, and weapons from the Bullet Farm. All driven, of course, by the most important W, which is want. And it's just that desperate want to stay alive that keeps them moving. When we came to Dementus, George's theory was that obviously we needed a different historical MO. And that different historical MO is Genghis Khan. So it's sweeping across the steppes. It's the locust plague mentality instead, where you accrete more and more and more mercenaries as you overtake them, which is great. I think I refer to it as the last great Ponzi scheme on Earth, where the currency was blood and oil. And so Dementus instead doesn't offer anybody a future, but he offers them a better planned and a better supplied present. So spoils now and oils often was his way of gathering everybody. But of course, the more you gather, the more you need to feed, fuel, etc. And so he's constantly got to grow. So in a way, he was probably the main reason for the fall in my head, which is the great economic conundrum of you have to keep growing, otherwise you're fucked. And I believe we were.
Now, considering the amount of thought that you've put into all of these characters and where they come from and, you know, what vehicles they ride, my following question would be, hypothetically, if you were a character in the Mad Max universe, who would you be? Where would you come from? What tribe would you belong to? Or, you know, maybe you don't belong to any tribe. And most importantly, what vehicle would you like to ride?
Well, it's... whenever I was asked the question of my favourite, it was always the Giga Horse, because it was one that was built from the ground up. And this time through, probably the Chariot, because it was the way to isolate Dementus, to see him grow, to take the vehicle that he had, which was... Now, I had a slightly different story to George for Dementus's backstory, but only because George was busy on 3,000 Years of Longing when I began. And so, you know, we started working up who the characters were, etc., beforehand. So I guess if I was going to choose, I think I'd be more likely now that I'm, you know, nearly 70, and, you know, my days of... I did test drive nearly all the vehicles on Fury Road, and much less on Furiosa, there being, you know, 140-something motorbikes. So I was always the hanger on the sidecars, the weight, rather than the actual driver, rider. So I guess, I don't know, I'm probably reached the point in my life where I'd have to cover myself in teeny tiny writing and pretend I was a history man, rather than an active character.
Fair enough. You know, you would be great as the guy at the beginning of Furiosa that tells us the story of this saga, you know, the story that this character went through. Or one of the writers, you know.
But George wouldn't have liked it because I have a different story to his.
that is
fair. That's how we make it slightly denser and more interesting.
Yes, different versions. Well, you know, the vehicles in Fury Road and Furiosa, as we've established, are big, crazy, and completely maximalist. But I was wondering, were there any rules that you took into consideration or anything that you considered to make sure that these vehicles still remain grounded and somewhat realistic?
Well, they were all more than somewhat realistic, particularly for Fury Road. Everything had to. So we decided there's a tendency in a lot of films that the art department will make their version, so we're going to choose this car, and then the special effects team will come in and make their 15 different versions that have to do 15 different things. I was very adamant and keen that we would build the vehicle that could do its own stunts. So everybody was theoretically the Tom Cruise of the automobile universe. So they were all able to do their own stunts because they were all able to drive at a speed required for the specific stunt, they were able to survive those stunts. I mean, the war rig had, I think my art director Jacinta had done a book that was 164 different pages of all the stunts that acted on the war rig. And that is what led us to make the first war rig covered in black pitch, so that, because we never shoot in order, crash after crash, we could slap it back on, get it back running overnight, so it could be anywhere in the show, and then you just dress it backwards and forwards to there. So all of them had to do their own stunts. They all had to be real. I have a thing that if you defy gravity, nothing personal, Dom, but Fast and Furious, ridiculous. there's a problem that you don't get that feeling, the hairs on the back of your neck, because there's no gravity, so there's no truth, so you don't have any skin in the game. So our theory is to always put the skin back in the game, put the flesh at risk, be playing, be gambling, not for matchsticks or peanuts, but for real life.
I couldn't agree more. Great answer. Okay, well, moving on, my following question would be, as we know, Fury Road and Furiosa are part of a new rebooted Mad Max universe. Of course, you know, they are genetically tied to the original Mad Max trilogy, Mad Max, Road Warrior, and Beyond Thunderdome, but, you know, they are not a continuation of that story, unless you believe the theory that Tom Hardy is actually, you know, the rebellious child that we see in the Road Warrior, which I don't know if you believe in or not.
No.
Thank you. Well, considering that, what are some of the challenges you faced when reinventing part of the visual style of the Mad Max universe? You know, were there any elements from the original trilogy that carried through into this new rebooted universe?
Well, I think Fury Road starts with the handing off of the baton. So the whole point was, we didn't have Mel, but we did have another Max. But just like, I don't know, do you guys have the Phantom comics here?
I am familiar with the Phantom.
The Ghost Who Walks. So, you know, down through generation after generation, the same 6'4", good-looking, well, muscle-packed sort of dude, just kept having children at the right time to continue on for centuries. So the pirates were always nervous. So this was our theory with the reboot, that it is Max. What is Max? Max is just the hero. Mm-hmm. He is the almost myth. And so this was Max, just had gone through more hell. And who's to say, if you go through enough hell, you don't end up looking like Tom Hardy. So we basically used the Interceptor, the V8, as the handoff. That was the baton switch that went from one hand to the other. So we opened Fury Road with that. That connects everybody. The other rules that would have held were that, well, one of the rules was, if you're going to bother salvage something for the future, then it has to be worth saving. If it's going to be worth saving, then it has to have an innate beauty or aesthetic. Otherwise, you may not understand it, but there's just this misremembered half-love, you know, like you might have had for, you know, your mother, depending on how your sexuality worked out. But basically, it was an attempt to keep the 70s sort of feel that Max came out of, because the vehicles, it was no good getting a nice new computer-controlled, battery-powered car in carbon fibre, because the minute you get rammed into by the first vehicle, the things are right off and you can't go anywhere. So heavy Detroit steel, real V8s, something that got your blood boiling. Those things all carried through and were part of the aesthetic and the love, the stuff that you were trying to save. So those were the rules that let us keep on the same path, if jumping slightly backwards and forwards as we did with Fury Road, and then backwards into Furiosa.
Now, moving on, the attention to detail in this Mad Max movies is quite frankly unprecedented. You know, you could spend hours analyzing every vehicle and every movie part and every little tiny bit.
I did.
I can imagine. You know, I've done in a smaller extent, but, you know, I'm sure you know them like the palm of your hand. And considering that, that brings me to my next question, which is there any detail that is perhaps a bit harder to find or hasn't been talked about all that much that you are still very proud of?
Look, there's what do they call them now? Easter eggs. There's thousands upon thousands of them, and one of the our salvage artists. I have a tendency to be more word oriented, and so telling the story and then involving them in the story was sort of how we started. And when I went to Africa the first time to build, there was still no script. There was just the storyboard. So I put together a rough animatic and would talk people through, which was interesting in, you know, the four different languages that we had working. We had three or four Australians, some English, New Zealand, South Africans, a couple of English, Namibians, Angolans, and even Americans. We didn't draw the line anywhere. Jesus. And so we would tell them the story. And this was the idea. But there's so many things in there where, you know, there might be a line of poetry that is why we've built something a particular way. Or if you look for a while, you'll see, say, the claw car. There's one called the Barracuda. So, you know, I think it's basically a lack of imagination on my part that the steering wheel for that was actually the steering wheel from a yacht. Because I had to put a harpoon in the front, we moved the motor into the centre of the vehicle and it sat over the shoulder of the driver, which gave us a great shot for when the chain breaks the window. And so everything, there was more pushed into the car. And obviously they each of them had a different mode of claw or ploughing that dropped down into the ground. And so that one, of course, was a collection of anchors. And so everything in that vehicle had a sort of, you know, maritime or aquatic connection. But whether anyone cares or not is nothing to do with it. It gave us a way to operate. So when we went on to Furiosa, we had... Basically, George wanted thousands of motorbikes to attack the Citadel to lay siege. Much as I love to build... we didn't really think we'd get much the other side of 150 before we ran out of time and money. And but if you're going to do 1,000 or 2,000 or 3,000 motorbikes, then you need to have a story about where all of them came from. And so we had to work out. And again, George wasn't there at the beginning. So he told me there was going to be 12 henchmen. And those 12 henchmen, therefore, in my head, well, there's 12 different tribes. That'll give me a different colour, look, texture, feel, weight, different sort of motorbikes, different sort of... And so we started off with the Dirty Dozen. George said, oh, I haven't cast anyone for the henchmen yet. Okay, well, let's say 10. So there's the 10 Lost Tribes of Israel, and we'll run through those with... their different variations. And then we got to the 7, 9 Dantean Circles of Hell, 7 we were up to with the Deadly Sins. I think I got as far as Enid Blyton's Fabulous 5. And George still hadn't cast any of the henchmen. So I got worried that we were down to Abbott and Costello and I'd already built enough different vehicles for 12 tribes. So we broke those tribes down into who would be ready at the end of the world to take advantage of the fall. And so, of course, that's the paranoid, the preppers. They've already got motorbikes, bullets, baked beans. They're all ready to go. The bikie groups who were already bandits of the bitumen and used to being a brotherhood. The militias, you know, the paranoid and the paramilitary. Cops and robbers. You open the prisons, they're already... they're already institutionalized, but they're going to come together and be a group. Refugees, another group. Sadly, in Australia, we have a tendency to sometimes be very unfair to our refugees and lock them up in desert, distant spaces where we try not to think about it too much. And these people, finally, twice lost to the world, now get a chance for revenge on it. So the refugees became another feel or a look. The preppers, we said the Rubillies, the ex-SAS. So we basically had a dozen different looks, gave them colours, textures, different sorts of motorbikes, different MOs, and that we managed to sort of set all of those up so that there was a sort of a baseline. to when we exaggerated out to thousand upon thousand, we could run.
Wow. The amount of references and intertextuality you just dropped in that answer was insane, but I love it. Thank you, Colin. Now, my following question is, much has been talked about a potential sequel to Fury Road called Mad Max the Wasteland. If a sequel to Fury Road were to happen, are there any crazy new vehicles that you would like to bring to life?
First off, it probably won't be me. I was too young for the first Max, and I think I'll be too old for the next one. George is the mastermind. I'm just a mister who gets mine, and I think they might mine elsewhere next time round. There's talk. George has always had the beautiful idea of one of our three being an anime, and at the moment that's being explored, I believe. But the Wasteland story was basically a way to get from Mel to Tom, was to work our Max character through to that point of almost insanity where we open Fury Road, and where he re-puts together his Interceptor, so that there's that sort of growth and build and his story, which also was another chance to actually visit Gastown and the Bullet Farm, etc. So this time round, Furiosa was our way to develop those other ideas. But even in Fury Road, we knew exactly what Gastown was built on, how it operated, etc., how the Bullet Farm worked. So it was whatever they do for the Wasteland, I'm sure there'll be more than enough new and original wonderment.
Well, many people have described the Mad Max universe and the Mad Max movies as myth, legends, you know, epics akin to the Iliad or the Odyssey. You yourself just dropped so many literary references that, you know, it makes sense. And, you know, you yourself, in your Oscar acceptance speech, you described the character of Furiosa as an amputee Amazon. That brings me to my following question, which is, are there any elements from mythology or literature that influence the sets, vehicles, and props you envision?
Thousand upon thousand. Everything is a reference. Everything is... So, directors, I don't know, I mean, not to generalise, but if you're a director, you're trying to simplify a story. You're trying to condense and make it as clear and straight as possible. So there's a tendency to allegory and the fable. Sorry, I shouldn't say fable now the Megalopolis is out. That may have killed the idea of fable. But I'm on the production design version of, I figure my job is to put the all into allegory and the fab into fable, and so I'll be against their better judgment adding as much detail, as much resonance, as much echo as possible, because film, like any art, is a call and response. We don't exist until you watch the show and you respond to certain things. The more things we can put into it, George, if you don't agree with me, I understand. The more we can put into it, the better. Because then people have things to respond to. Somebody might, you know, three people in the audience might go, oh, Trojan horse. Oh, he's on the tow truck now. I think, do you imagine that Colin really thought it was Hannibal's elephant? Because we've already done Caesar coming into Rome at the Citadel. We've already had him. He starts off and it's the engine of his car is actually a 2700 Rotec aeroplane engine, but it's been mounted sideways, which is really bad for the oil consumption, I have to tell you. But it looks great, and it worked, and it gave us a three wheel for him, so that he had three circles instead of two like everybody else's, so that we had him as a separate thing. So the references are legion. They are, and it's not just me, everybody. We start talking to the salvage artists or the set deck or to someone who's stitching a steering wheel, and they've got this particular cross stitch that just happens to be the same as the one that was used in a, you know, Roman in a Roman's leggings. And so you go, yeah, that's great. Nobody is ever going to get that. Nobody cares. But we care, and it is important, and it does add one more layer of something that people might respond to. I'm a great believer in Spiritus Mundi, in the species understanding, and that there is knowledge that we get, vestigial through some sort of fashion from all of our history. That if we were just the one character, our species, then we would share all of those ideas and feelings. So the more that we can echo something that you may have heard in primary school, you know, a story about someone who stood on the bridge and defeated everybody, then that little click means something. And suddenly that guy standing alone, stopping everybody here, means something more. It has an echo, it has a resonance. So we're basically here in the business of echo.
Now, speaking of your Oscar acceptance speech, where, of course, you refer to Furiosa as an amputee Amazon, I actually remember watching the 2016 Academy Awards, which is when you won your Oscar for Mad Max Fury Road. I think I might have been 14 years old. I was just starting to get really interested and passionate about filmmaking. And in fact, I believe these Academy Awards were the first ever Oscars that I watched from start to finish. And, you know, forgive me, but I didn't really know who you were, and I didn't really know what production design was or what it meant. But I do remember that your acceptance speech really made me think. You know, I remember that you went up on stage to get your Oscar, and instead of starting your speech by saying something cliche, like, I would like to thank the Academy or something like that, you started your speech by saying, it never ceases to annoy me how many people it takes to make me look competent. And, you know, first of all, I think that speaks volumes to the collaborative nature of filmmaking. But also, you know, as a 14-year-old watching the Academy Awards, it really made me think, and it really made me come to realize that, you know, when it comes to filmmaking, no man is an island, and that collaboration is absolutely key. And that brings me to my next question, which is, what advice would you give young creatives who want to pursue careers in a collaborative art such as cinema?
Well, I like to think I'm the coal in collaborative, so exactly what I said. Nobody makes something by themselves. Directors have incredibly, incredibly great ideas and powerful energies and force, but they know as much as anybody that the battles and the war that you make to push that through, knock things around the edges, change it, and often for the better. I'm a believer that you do need to leave space for magic to happen, and that if you don't have cracks, then the light doesn't get in, and you end up with something hermetically sealed and airless and boring. And so I'm very, very lucky that my job allows me to meet and steal the talent and passion of hundreds of other people who have all, as I said then, made me look almost competent, which is quite an effort.
If you don't have cracks, the light doesn't come in. Come on, put that on a shirt somewhere. You know, we've got to start merchandising that.
I think Leonard Cohen may have already done so.
There you go. Well, grateful regardless. You know, closing, wrapping up this interview, my penultimate question that I would like to ask you is, out of every movie you've watched, what would you say are your favorite sets? You know, the sets that inspired a young Colin Gibson to pursue this career?
I'm not going to be able to answer that, because I don't think there were sets that inspired I don't remember what a young Colin Gibson was inspired by. I think it was girls. possibly alcohol. I don't think it was sets. It didn't really start with that sort of passion. My passion was for helping to tell the story. I spent a long time, a short-ish, say 5 years in theatre as an actor and tour manager, and 5-10 years as a props guy, and then 5 years again as an art director. It was slowly discovering that this was a way for me to imposter syndrome my way into a space where I could do what I love to do, which is to think and to share and to collaborate, as you said. And so there probably were none. I think as I got older, you know, Parasite is probably the perfect recent example of a show where the design was implicit to the story, to the not just the specific story, but to the socioeconomic, geopolitical, the complete Korean story of life in society. And so I think they were great, great sets, beautifully done, brilliantly put together. But, you know, there's so many guys. You know, probably my favourite film is Shoplifters by Koreeda, Japanese. Now, there's no incredibly great sets. They were probably all locations, maybe just one that wasn't. But it was a story where you loved every character in a different way. And yet they all deserved love. And I could ask nothing more.
Oh, I love both Parasite and Shoplifter, so that makes me really, really happy. And so I guess a young Colin Gibson wasn't inspired in any movie sets in particular. You were just inspired in traumatizing children by eventually shooting a scene where a dog dangles from a bridge and almost drowns himself.
Absolutely. I'm more than happy to share George's darkest passions.
You heard it here first, folks. Colin is out to get you. Now, my last question, and this is a question that I'd like to ask to everyone that I interview here in Take One. And, you know, of course, you've already mentioned Shoplifters, but apart from Shoplifters, what would you say are some of your favorite films? You know, the movies that really inspire you and move you?
I just went and had breakfast down the road, and in the background, I sat at a counter, and I think because the place is quite lovely, there was Casablanca was playing on two different screens, and they were both disjunct. And so I was watching different moments in Casablanca while I drank coffee, and there was, I've already got one shot I want to steal, and I was almost remembering word for word the Peter Lorre speech of, "You don't like me very much, do you Rick?" And even though the sound was turned down, it was just great to see that sort of stuff. Seven Samurai, Kurosawa, obviously is I could watch that all the time. Bizarrely, any of the Jean Caro, you know, right to Amelie, you know, which is really just a stalker seen through a sunny sort of lens, is a beautiful film. Again, where colour and texture and life play such an important part in setting the tone so that the magic can happen.
Oh, these are some of the best movie recommendations we've had from one of the interviewees. Thank you, Colin. You truly are. I am completely shocked by how much an encyclopedia of knowledge and references and wisdom you are. So thank you for joining us.
You'll feel the same when you hit 70.
Let's hope I do. I'll be very happy if I do. Thank you. Okay, well, that has been it for this interview with the incredible, the amazing Colin Gibson. Thank you for joining us, and thank you all so much for watching. Goodbye.
Welcome back to Take One. This is your host, Juan Pablo Sá, talking to you from CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver. Okay, you guys just listened to my interview with the one and only, the incredible Colin Gibson, once again, production designer for Mad Max Fury Road and Furiosa. If you just listened to the interview, you probably just heard what an incredible guy he is, not only as an artist, but also as a person. Truly a very funny, a great conversationalist, and also an incredibly knowledgeable person. I was shocked by all the references that he brought up. It was truly insane. And, you know, when I was interviewing him, I was getting some of the references he was saying, but some of them were just flying way over my head. And I actually really enjoyed editing the interview and, you know, in the meantime, investigating some of the concepts, some of the references, some of the things that he was bringing up. And I feel like I learned so much. And, yeah, I am truly very impressed. Okay, so yeah, that was my interview with Colin Gibson that I did last year in October of 2024 for the Vancouver International Film Festival. Now, I figured there's still 10 more minutes. I don't think there's a lot of time left, but, you know, we'll see. When we come back from this musical break, we might talk a little bit about some of the Oscar nominations that were recently announced. Maybe we won't. I don't know. Let's see how the time goes. But for now, let's go to a quick musical break and listen to another song also featured in the movies that Colin Gibson worked on. So previously, we listened to Brothers in Arms by Junkie XL, which is featured in Mad Max Fury Road. And now we are going to listen to The Darkest of Gods, which is a song also by Junkie XL, but this one is featured this time in Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. Actually, looking at the clock and looking at the length of the song, I don't think we will have time for anything else to discuss anything else after the musical break. So enjoy the song. And next episode of Take One will be not next week, but 2 weeks from now. So that would be Tuesday, February 11th. And I believe that on Tuesday, February 11th, unless my plans change, on Tuesday, February 11th, I will talk about all the movies that I saw in 2024's Vancouver International Film Festival. I watched a lot of movies at last year's VIFF. You know, some of them are even nominated for Oscars right now. If you tune in 2 weeks from now on Tuesday, February 11th at 5 p.m., you will catch me talking about everything I watched at 2024's Vancouver International Film Festival. But without further ado, here is The Darkest of Gods by Junkie XL from the movie Furiosa, a Mad Max saga. And here we go.
log, stardate 50929.4. 2 days ago, this station felt like a tomb. But
thanks to CITR,
it now seems as though a new spirit has swept through the station, as if someone had opened a door and let a gust of fresh air blow through a musty old house.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver. Broadcasting the otherworldly every day. Always fresh, never musty. Devin Cole is a woman in total control. Unafraid and unashamed, Cole has burst onto the scene through her expertly crafted feminist pop anthems, packaging social truths into repeat-worthy bops. This is the era of fempop, and Devin Cole is an artist you don't want to miss. Join Devin Cole on her Two Shades Blonder tour and see her in Vancouver at the Biltmore Cabaret on March 16th. To find out more and get your tickets, visit admitone.com. That's admitone.com. I should be smitten, but I'm a fiend for the troublesome boy who's driving me wild. Keeping me on the tip of my tongue. Lebanon is facing a deep humanitarian crisis with nearly 1.2 million people displaced. In response, Lebanese diaspora and friends have organized a silent auction to raise funds for mutual aid initiatives on the ground, providing essential aid like food, sanitary products, and emergency shelter. You can bid via app.galabid.com/VAN2, as in the number, LEBANON. The auction will close at 11:59 p.m. Pacific Time on Friday, October 11th. Or if you're interested in donating funds, you can reach out today via email at Vancouver2, as in the number, Lebanon@gmail.com.